the extremist forces in the rebel movement when with any military action you take in Syria, and that the moderate forces that we champion there, meaning the United States champion there, are not strong enough to run the country at this point. So that's, you know, I think there are lots of questions to be asked about that, and I'd like to hear more information on what makes us think that the moderates are in the ascendancy.
Well, in July, during his battle for renomination as the U.S.'s top military officer, chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, Martin Dempsey, warned against military action in Syria, as you point out. He said, quote, the regime could withstand limited strikes by dispersing its assets. But during Tuesday's congressional hearings, he appeared to have reversed his position.
We're preparing several target sets, the first of which would set the conditions for follow-on assessments, and the others would be used if necessary, and we haven't gotten to that point yet. What we do know is that we can degrade and disrupt his capabilities, and that should put us in a better position to make the kind of assessment you're talking about.
And then you have Secretary of State Kerry initially refusing to rule out the eventual deployment of boots on the ground, saying he can't take an option off the table.
In the event there was a threat of a chemical weapons cache falling into the hands of al-Nusra or someone else, and it was clearly in the interests of our allies and all of us, the British, the French, and others, to prevent those weapons of mass destruction falling into the hands of the worst elements, I don't want to take off the table an option that might or might not be available to a president of the United States to secure our country.
Now, later he would walk this back, but Mark Seibel, this is extremely important, significant, both what Dempsey said before and also what Secretary of State Kerry said yesterday as he talked about, you know, what happens, he said, if Syria implodes.
Well, I mean, you know, I think that's what Dempsey was saying in his letter to McCain and Levin back in July, which is once you start a military campaign, and we can call this not classic war, but it's a military campaign. Once you start it, you really don't know where it's going to go. And it's the, as he put it, unintended consequences that you have to be concerned with. And so you do have to have a strategy for what you're going to do if, for example, the country collapses, or if you so weaken an Assad military force that they suddenly lose control of their chemical weapons stores, and that a group like the Islamic State of Iraq or al-Nusra comes in and captures them. And then what do you do? That's a real concern. And so the fact that he is holding open the possibility of having to put boots on the ground, and he did come back to that theme, and he never really rejects it. He says, we don't want to do that, but he keeps the option there, is an expression, and probably a smart one, of understanding that once you begin a military operation, you do not know where it will lead. And you need to have your options open. So the question then becomes, I think, for Congress, well, do you want to start? And if you start, are you prepared to finish?
Well, during Tuesday's Senate hearing, Republican Senator Rand Paul accused the administration of playing, quote, constitutional theater with Congress.
You're making a joke of us. You're making us into theater. And so we play constitutional theater for the president. If this is real, you will abide by the verdict of Congress. You're probably going to win. Just go ahead and say it's real, and let's have a real debate in this country and not a meaningless debate that in the end you lose and you say, oh, well, we had the authority anyway. We're going to go ahead and go to war anyway.
So, Mark Seibel, very quickly, before we conclude, what do you think is going to happen now?
Oh, well, I don't know. I think there's going to be a lot of debate. I suspect that the common wisdom is in Washington is that the Senate will authorize action.
And we have 5 seconds, Mark.
And that it's very close in the House.
Mark Seibel, we want to thank you very much for being with us, Chief of Correspondents for McClatchy Newspapers. We'll link to your piece, "To Some U.S. Case for Syrian Gas Attack Strike Has Too Many Holes." I'm Amy Goodman with Nermeen Sheikh.
You're listening to KBOO Portland. Next up is the evening news.
Triangle Productions and KBOO Community Radio are proud to present Kiss of a Spider Woman. The Oregon premiere of this 7-time Tony Award-winning musical will be at The Sanctuary at 1785 Northeast Sandy Boulevard in Portland. The show will run from September 5th through the 29th. More information about this KBOO-sponsored event may be found at kboo.fm on the right-hand side of the homepage under Community Events.
The KBOO Board of Directors elections are underway. KBOO members can vote for up to 4 candidates. Ballots were mailed in mid-August. If you think you are a KBOO member and have not received a ballot, email Membership Director Andrew Geller at membership@kboo.org or call 503-231-8032, extension 207. Non-members can join KBOO and receive a ballot to vote. Just go to kboo.fm and click Donate on the top right-hand corner. The annual meeting is Sunday, September 15th from 1 to 4 p.m. at the Matt Dishman Community Center at 77 Northeast Knott Street in Portland. You can mail back your ballot or bring it to KBOO at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue in Portland. Ballots must be postmarked by September 10th or cast at the annual meeting by 2:40 p.m. to count. Get informed, get involved, and vote. Thanks.
This KBOO program is made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Portland's Gay Yellow Pages, providing a resource guide of openly gay-friendly businesses, organizations, and services since 1996. New smartphone app available for all iPhones and Droids. For more information, you can visit pdxgyp.com.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, leaders of Occupy Portland presented a plan to end homelessness to City Hall.
The U.S. Senate Foreign Intelligence Committee has voted to approve use of force against Syria.
And record-high radiation levels were detected at the Fukushima nuclear plant today.
Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Wednesday, September 4th, 2013. I'm Aaron J. Bernard.
And I'm Brian Pritchett. Representatives of Occupy Portland presented a 6-point plan to end homelessness to Mayor Charlie Hales and the City Council today. Organizers of the plan call it a practical and cost-effective solution to the city's homelessness problem. KBOO reporter Joe Myers spoke with presenter Mike Witte on the specifics of the plan.
We had fun. We were finally able to present our 6-point plan to end homelessness to the City Council. We've been waiting for about 2 months now. We had to get all those guys together, so September 4th was the only day that the mayor and all 4 City Council members were going to be present. So we presented our 6-point plan, which in a nutshell consists of no longer spending these huge amount of money on these temporary shelters. We'd like to see eco-villages established. I think they're a perfect answer to the homeless issue long-term in Portland. Kind of revolutionary in America for the homeless, but not revolutionary for the rest of the world that these camps are already set up in. So number two, we'd like to see a relief camp effort enacted. And third, the City Council denied the churches about a year and a half ago the right to establish some tents in their parking lot at night so that people would be able to sleep quietly, safely, warmly, dryly in their parking lots, supervised. In that situation, you would just go pop a tent, get in it, go to sleep, wake up at dawn, and leave. So it's a dusk till dawn type thing. No fraternizing, no drink, no, really strict. You go, you sleep. Them are the rules. Number four, we're going to have to take some of these buildings that we have, that we own as a city, and use volunteers and some donated building materials and accommodate these buildings to house people. So that's number four. Number five is parks and camping. That campground that Portland owns, it's called Dodge Park out there in Clackamas County on the Sandy River, should be utilized for a campground this this fall while it's closed, all the way until the spring when it opens. It's already there. And part of 5-2 is being able to lease some land and operate a campground as well. So at number 6, we need to incorporate some social services into all of these. That includes employment opportunities. It includes social work as far as getting the mental and emotional help that they need in some cases. And education. A lot of people are eligible for Pell Grants and could be going to school right now if they just had that information, people to walk them through that.
What's the good news, Mike?
Well, the good news is that the mayor has been interested in this six-point plan for a couple weeks now. And so we've had some conversations with Dana in his office. We believe that they do want to move forward, and I personally believe that they all would like to move forward.
The presentation was preceded by a rally at City Hall. The creation of the plan was prompted in part by the July eviction of homeless protesters from the former Occupy Portland encampment.
Oregon resident Pete Seda has finally been cleared of all charges after a 12-year-long saga of fighting bogus terrorism and money laundering charges. Seda was picked up shortly after the September 11, 2001 attacks and charged with terrorism for his work with a charity group in the former Soviet Union. He spent more than 2 years in prison, most of it without any contact with his family. After being cleared of terrorism charges, federal prosecutors continued to pursue an unfounded allegation that Seda laundered money to charity groups in Chechnya. Now, those charges have been completely cleared as well. His initial conviction was overturned, and Pete Seda is a free man. But he will not be compensated for the 12 years of his life spent fighting the bogus charges and serving time in jail. Seda is now living in Portland and working in a deli.
The Sweet Cakes by Melissa Bakery in Gresham has officially closed its doors. In January, owners Melissa and Aaron Klein refused to bake a wedding cake for a lesbian couple, defending their refusal as freedom of religious expression. The owners say their wedding cake sales plummeted after news of this service denial spread. In a statement to the Christian Broadcasting Network, the Kleins claimed that discrimination opponents employed mafia-style tactics to force the business closure. In August, the Bureau of Labor and Industries began an investigation of the Kleins for possible violations of the Oregon Equality Act of 2007, which mandates that people cannot be denied service based on sexual orientation. As the Kleins move their business to an in-home bakery, the investigation continues.
An explosion of mosquito populations in Coos County this summer has led county officials to approve a plan to spray pesticides over 10,000 acres of the county. The target area includes 300 acres of the Bandon Marsh National Wildlife Refuge and surrounding areas. Mosquito populations in Coos County have been rising since 2011, when U.S. Fish and Wildlife Services performed tidal restoration projects in the wildlife refuge. For more, we go to Rachel Bennett speaking with Scott Black, Executive Director of the Xerces Society.
They created ponds within the tidal marsh that are separated from the ocean, basically stagnant ponds that are perfect breeding grounds for the mosquitoes. So from what we can tell, the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service really messed up here, and they created this problem. But the solution is not to spray toxic insecticides over 10,000 acres.
Will you tell me about the plan for getting rid of the mosquitoes?
The U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, Bandon Refuge, is going to allow large-scale spraying over the refuge for mosquitoes. The plan involves spraying dibrome, which is a toxic organophosphate nerve agent that's highly toxic to humans as well as a range of wildlife. This spraying will occur by airplane. It'll be over the marsh, but it'll also be over beaches, over houses, over the forest. This toxic broad-spectrum insecticide, I feel, will affect everything from honeybees and native pollinators and butterflies, as well as all the aquatic organisms. It's also toxic to humans. So if I lived in that area, I'd take a vacation if I could while they sprayed, and I'd make sure that I don't eat my fall produce because I wouldn't want to be feeding my kids these toxic substances that are going to be sprayed across the landscape.
How is this project going to be funded?
Well, it sounds like they've cobbled together a variety of funding sources. There is some private funding coming into this, but there's public funding from the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service is what we've heard is part of this. And that's another issue. I do not think that we should be using public funding to in a project that, one, won't work, and two, likely will cause problems to, everything from crustaceans, crabs, the aquatic insects, to other wildlife, and is toxic to humans.
Is there some type of chemical that can be used to reduce mosquito populations that is not toxic to the environment and people and organisms?
Yes, well, there's an entire strategy that should be used to minimize the impact to the environment. There are really no products that have no impact. We should know that. Everything we do has an impact. But if you target just those areas where the mosquitoes are breeding, not where they're flying, but where they're breeding, and if you use the least toxic substance, in this case it would probably be BTI, which is a really minimally toxic insecticide, very targeted to get the breeding mosquitoes, this is the way to control the problem, not a large-scale spraying of toxic substances.
I've been speaking with Scott Black, Executive Director of the Xerces Society. This is Rachel Bennett with KBOO News.
Despite numerous deaths due to a parasite, a small herd of an estimated 60 moose still roam throughout the Umatilla and Wallowa-Whitman National Forest in Oregon. Considered to be Oregon's only moose herd, their number has doubled in the past 7 years. These elusive, mysterious creatures migrated from the Washington-Spokane region across the Palouse Prairie and into the northeastern Blue Mountains. Known as Shearer's moose, the Oregon moose is the smallest subspecies of this animal. Still, the males weigh in at 1,000 pounds, and the females weigh 700 to 800 pounds. In 1960, the first Oregon moose was sighted by the Imnaha River. In 2010, biologists discovered a moose infected with carotid worms, which are transmitted by horsefly bites. These tiny parasites enter the brains via blood vessels and can trigger poor coordination, blindness, and other health problems. Despite parasites, biologists say the herd is expanding, with 3 moose calves born in 2005.
You are listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned for Free Speech Radio News after this newscast, followed by treasures from the KBOO archives at 6. At 7, it's Hard Knock Radio, news and views from a hip-hop perspective. The National Weather Service has issued a special weather statement advising there may be heavy rainfall between today and Friday. Tomorrow's weather is expected to be wet with a chance of thunderstorms and a high of 70 degrees.
It is 5:18. Time now for daily commentary from Jim Hightower.
Big banks have never been very popular. But their recent greed, frauds, and demand for taxpayer bailouts have made them less popular than pond scum. So it's good to see them now reaching out personally to us commoners with special offers and a neighborly, friendly banker attitude. For example, I recently got a personal invitation from a branch manager of J.P. Morgan Chase, America's largest bank. Okay, it wasn't that personal. It was addressed to our neighbor. But still, it was a friendly invite for me to become, ta-da, a Chase private client. As such, I would get my own private client banker who would guide me through Chase's, quote, premium products. Gosh, I wondered, would those include some of the crappy mortgage securities that Chase has been foisting on customers, apparently knowing the products were losers, which has led prosecutors across the country to pursue fraud charges against the bank? But moving right along, the letter promised that I would also have a private client advisor who'd give me access to, quote, J.P. Morgan's world-class investment expertise. Gosh, I wondered again, would that include advice to buy stuff like the ill-fated investment in complex derivatives packaged by a Chase broker nicknamed the London Whale? A bet that went upchuckingly sour, causing $6.2 billion in losses and leading to both criminal and civil charges for mismanagement and misrepresentation that will likely force the bank itself to admit guilt. This is Jim Hightower saying, of course, the friendly branch manager was not responsible for Morgan's long rap sheet, but why should I, or anyone, sign up with an outfit that's so corrupt from the top down that it's being pursued for wrongdoing by 8 federal agencies, 2 foreign governments, 4 states, and numerous investors and customers? Thanks, J.P. Morgan Chase, but no thanks.
To get more of Jim Hightower's populist take on what Wall Street and Washington are up to, visit www.hightowerlowdown.org.
A meeting held on Saturday between representatives of a local Wyoming branch of the National Association for the Advancement of Colored People, the NAACP, and leaders of the Ku Klux Klan is causing division at the national level of the NAACP. Jimmy Simmons, president of the Casper, Wyoming branch of the NAACP, sent a letter to the Klan asking to meet after racist literature distributed in the area went unaddressed by the police. John Abar of the United Klans of America, based out of Great Falls, Montana, responded to the call, and the two men met this past Saturday. The meeting is believed to be the first such meeting between the two groups. After working out ground rules, such as having heavy security present for the meeting, the two men discussed views on segregation and the KKK's desire to secede from the United States. Rosemary Lytle, a regional coordinator of the NAACP, said that she had not approved the meeting and said the FBI has listed the Klan as a hate group. But the organization may accept the membership of the Klan leader, who offered to join the NAACP after the meeting.
The state-level implementation of the Affordable Care Act goes into effect this fall, with the full health exchange available for individuals and families in January. Kevin Kane is the healthcare organizer for Citizen Action of Wisconsin. He's a supporter of the Affordable Care Act, which he says will prevent him from being discriminated against due to his pre-existing conditions. In addition, Kane says that certain states that have implemented health reform properly are succeeding. He blames Wisconsin Governor Scott Walker, a conservative Republican, for refusing billions of dollars in federal funds that he says would provide insurance for many families who are currently living without it. He spoke this morning on KBOO's Air Cascadia.
Sure. Well, this is a perfect example of why it pays to really pay attention to what other states are doing. And so we have the ability to see that the states of Indiana and Ohio and a number of others, conservative-led states, have really tried to twist the data to make it look like the new costs for healthcare were going to be really high. And so we saw that, and we're preparing for our governor to do the same. He's been obviously no friend of the Affordable Care Act. And so this week, they planned on doing a series of town halls around the state on the Affordable Care Act, his administration. And then yesterday morning, they released a press release not showing the data, not saying what different companies are going to charge, but little percentage increases of what they speculate people will pay. But there's no way to tell if it's being truthful or not, and we can't help but notice that it doesn't talk about tax credits that people will get to reduce costs. It doesn't talk about protections on people with pre-existing conditions and charging women less, and it doesn't even talk about the quality of the plans. These plans are supposed to be better quality, and so all around it was a huge effort to try to make the law look bad, and we were able to jump on it right away and catch them on that. They are really just kind of playing back the party line and saying that this is the healthcare law or they're not allowed to share the data. They've given us all sorts of strange reasons, but in reality, we know they have the info. They're supposed to have released it by now. They're releasing just this little bit to try to scare people, and that's their tactic on this. And I think everyone is able to see through this transparent attack to try to confuse people.
That was Kevin Kane with Citizen Action of Wisconsin. Republican Governor Scott Walker is scheduled to speak at a fundraiser for a right-wing think tank in Seattle this Friday. Trade union groups have organized a picket outside the event to challenge Walker's policies of privatization and union busting.
The nation's second-largest grocer, Safeway, has just settled with the EPA in the largest case ever under the Clean Air Act. The case resolves allegations of Safeway violating the Clean Air Act by failing to promptly repair refrigeration coolant leaks. The coolant in question is HCFC-22, a hydrochlorofluorocarbon that is an ozone-depleting greenhouse gas. Under the details of the settlement, Safeway will pay a $600,000 civil penalty and reduce emissions on equipment at its stores nationwide. The EPA and Department of Justice estimate the repairs will cost Safeway over $4 million. Over 130 Northwest Safeway stores were listed in the settlement. Jared Blumenfeld, the EPA administrator for the Pacific Southwest region, spoke with KBOO reporter Jemai Cherry on the details and impact of the settlement.
Could you tell us a little bit just about the settlement that took place?
Today, United States Environmental Protection Agency, along with the Department of Justice, lodged a settlement against the Safeway grocery stores. The issue of the settlement related to refrigerants, and you may think, what's the big deal with refrigerants? Back in the 80s, science came together around the hole in the ozone layer, and people realized that aerosols and refrigerants, something called chlorofluorocarbon, these complex set of chemicals, were eroding the hole in the ozone layer and exposing us to UV radiation that caused all kinds of problems, from cataracts to you name it. And so as a result, countries came together and signed a treaty that phased out these chemicals, and it's largely been a success. It's one of these international things that we can point to and say, everyone agreed to get rid of these chlorofluorocarbons. They did. One of the things they replaced it with was another set of complex chemicals that are also refrigerants, hydrochlorofluorocarbons, and those are called HFCFCs. And those HCFCs are now the single most widely used substance that depletes the ozone layer. So the U.S. is committed to reducing those. The action today is really that we spent 5 years on this case, the largest case of its kind in the nation, and in Safeway's 659 stores. They're going to be taking action to reduce the amount of that refrigerant that leaks into the atmosphere.
This is this settlement was the first of its kind, and it's pretty large as far as its scope. Is this the first of several others that we're going to be seeing like it?
So, Jemai, this is certainly a national priority of EPA's. We want to make sure that the U.S. meets our commitment under these international agreements. It also turns out that these chemicals not only cause problems with the ozone layer, but they're very, very powerful and potent greenhouse gases. So this particular one, for instance, is about 1,800 times more potent than normal carbon dioxide. So it has a very, very big impact on climate change as well. This settlement will reduce about 33,000 pounds of this chemical going into the atmosphere every single year into the future. So it's a big deal. It's many stores. They're spending more than $4 million to help put in this equipment. And I think it sends a message to other stores that we take this seriously, and if entities are not in compliance, we will pursue them.
Is there any word on when these changes need to take place?
Yeah, in terms of when the changes need to take place, there's a schedule in the compliance settlement. And so we want, obviously, them to focus on the worst performing stores and entities first, and they need to have a emission reduction plan that gets them 10% reduction each year for the next 3 years, and then we have very specific milestones that they need to achieve in order to reduce the amount of leaks in their system.
That was Jared Blumenfeld of the EPA. This is Jemai Cherry with KBOO News.
Record high radiation levels were detected at the Fukushima nuclear plant on Tuesday. Officials said they had detected radiation levels of 2,200 millisieverts per hour near contaminated water storage tanks, up 20% from the previous high. This comes after officials said they detected levels 18 times higher than previously documented because the equipment they had been using could only measure up to 100 millisieverts per hour. The Japanese government announced a plan to spend $130 million to create a subterranean ice wall to try to stop the flow of radioactive water from the plant into the ocean. The ice wall technology has been used successfully before, but never on anything near this scale. The nuclear plant continues to leak around 300 tons of radioactive wastewater into the Pacific Ocean every day.
India is planning to take major action to reduce malnutrition and ease poverty by guaranteeing its citizens a right to food. The new plan calls for spending $20 billion to provide 800 million people with subsidized wheat, rice, and cereals. The legislation, called the Food Security Bill, was sent this week from Parliament to the President for approval. The bill is receiving considerable attention because of India's strained finances and current economic crisis.
The Senate Foreign Intelligence Committee has approved the use of U.S. military force in Syria. Today's vote came as the latest poll numbers from an ABC Washington Post poll show that people in the U.S. widely oppose war with Syria. Nearly 6 in 10 Americans oppose any missile strikes against Syria, even if U.N. investigators find that chemical attacks in August were carried out by the Syrian government. Meanwhile, the Secretary General of the United Nations said that any military action by the U.S. without U.N. Security Council approval would be considered illegal under international law. Dr. Meryl Nass says the United States and other nations pledged to get rid of all chemical weapons stores by 2008, but many of those chemical weapons have not yet been destroyed.
An international treaty regarding chemical weapons came into force in 1997, and 189 nations are parties to that treaty. Only 7 nations in the world are not. And the nations that are not parties do include Syria, Israel, North Korea. However, the United States and Russia and some other nations which are parties to this treaty all agreed to destroy all their chemical weapons in 10 years, so by 2007. There was a potential 5-year extension, but all chemical weapons had to be destroyed with no more extensions by 2012. Now, neither the United States nor Russia nor some other countries have completed destruction of their chemical weapons. And in fact, the United States has stockpiles of sarin in the U.S., which have leaked in the last few years, exposing Americans to sarin in the possession of the U.S. Army. I think it's just important to be aware that when the United States says we're frightened or we're upset because we know Syria has chemical weapons and specifically sarin, a nerve gas, Americans should understand that the United States also has tons of chemical weapons, including mustard gas and sarin and other nerve gases.
Professor Stephen Zunes from the University of San Francisco has written that U.S. policy regarding chemical weapons has been so inconsistent and politicized that the United States is in no position to take leadership in response to any use of such weaponry by Syria. He spoke to KBOO News today about this double standard.
One thing, the United States has been willing to tolerate the use of chemical weapons when it was seen as strategically important. The most notorious example was when Saddam Hussein was unleashing its chemical arsenal against Iranian forces during the Iran-Iraq war. U.S. personnel from the Defense Intelligence Agency were on the ground in Baghdad using U.S. satellite data to help the Iranians target concentrations of Iranian troops in the full knowledge that they were using chemical weapons. And I should mention that the Iraqi chemical weapons were made up in large part by chemicals provided by the United States, ostensibly for pesticides and fertilizer, but it was being converted to use into chemical weapons in the full knowledge of Reagan administration officials, but they decided to look the other way. Basically, it imposed unilateral sanctions against Syria by the United States, but it really didn't make that big a difference. In part because there was not a lot of trade between the United States and Syria anyway, but more importantly, it was rife with double standards, false accusations, and other things that made it very easy for the Syrian regime just to dismiss it as politically motivated, which it was. And while then, as now, there are certainly legitimate concerns about the behavior of the Syrian regime that should be addressed by the international community. This kind of unilateralism and double standards has been the hallmark of U.S. policy towards Syria all these years ends up being counterproductive. It just plays into the hands of the Assad regime that has so well manipulated the nationalist card to get people to rally around the flag and support the regime despite its oppression.
And what about the role of Israel in this? I understand that Israel has a chemical weapons production facility and a nuclear arsenal that could play a role in any potential conflict with Syria. What do you see as the role of Israel?
The very reason that Syria developed its chemical weapons some 40 years ago was in response to Israel's chemical and nuclear weapons. And that's why I stress that it is to have some kind of region-wide disarmament regime, because this attitude the United States has is, well, if you're an ally, you can have these kind of weapons, but if we don't like you, they must be banned. That's just not going to work. The only kind of disarmament that's really worked, that has really been sustainable, is one that was universally based, not one that was ideologically based.
Again, I've been speaking with Stephen Zunis, professor of politics and chair of Middle East Studies at the University of San Francisco. This is Jenka Soderberg with KBOO News.
As the U.S. considers taking unilateral military action in Syria, the Swedish government has offered blanket asylum for any Syrians seeking to flee the country. And today, a rebel group connected with al-Qaeda, which the U.S. has supported with weapons and funding, attacked a Christian village northeast of Damascus. The attack began this morning when a rebel fighter blew himself up and the group took over a government checkpoint, killing at least 8 government soldiers. The village, Mosula, is home to around 2,000 people who still speak a version of Aramaic, the ancient language of biblical times, also believed to have been spoken by Jesus.
And now, the latest news and developments from the occupied territories in Palestine, from the International Middle East Media Center in Bethlehem.
Welcome to Palestine Today, a service of the International Middle East Media Center, www.imemc.org, for Wednesday, September 4th, 2013. Israeli settlers and troops attack residents in East Jerusalem, leaving many injured, and political detainees halt their hunger strike. These stories and more coming up. Stay tuned. Palestinian medical sources in occupied Jerusalem have reported that several children and women were among the injured after extremist Israeli settlers broke into the yard of Al-Aqsa Mosque since early dawn hours Wednesday. The sources said that Palestinian child, identified as Ahmed Saad Marrar, 11, was shot by a rubber-coated metal bullet, while several women in the mosque were injured after being sprayed with pepper spray. Witnesses said that at least 50 Israeli extremists broke into the Al-Aqsa Mosque in small groups, and that dozens of Israeli police officers invaded the yards of the mosque through the Al-Mughrabi Gate and chased Muslim worshippers who tried to stop extremists from invading the mosque through the area. One of the workers of Al-Aqsa Mosque stated that the Israeli army and police kidnapped more than 50 Palestinians in Al-Aqsa Mosque after the police broke into and dragged the residents out. Dozens of Israeli troops and officers were deployed in the old city of Jerusalem as tension among residents remained high. Various extremist groups in Israel have called for attacking the Al-Aqsa Mosque on the eve of the new Jewish year, today on Wednesday. The call pushed hundreds of Palestinians to flock to the mosque in an attempt to stop extremists. In other news, the Palestinian Political Prisoner Society announced on Wednesday that 3 political detainees held by the Israeli army have stopped their hunger strike. According to the society, Adil Hribat and brothers Ayman and Mohammed Itbesh decided to end their strike they started in protest of the Israeli army administrative detention law. Adil and Ahmed started their protest move in May, while Muhammad joined them in July.
Israel's military uses the so-called administrative detention policy to hold Palestinians for longer times without charges or court cases. So far, the Israeli army holds captive 5,500 Palestinian political detainees, scores under administrative detention. And that's all for today from the IMEMC News. This was the Wednesday, September 4th news roundup from the occupied Palestinian territories. For more news and updates, please visit our website at www.imemc.org. Today's report has been brought to you by George Shmawi and me, Ghassan Bannoura.
You are listening to the KBU Evening News. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call us with your breaking news stories at 503-231-8032. Our production team for tonight's newscast is Jen Davis, Rachel Bennett, Robin Ryan, Jimmy Tardy, and Joe Meyer. The producer is Jemai Cherry. Special thanks to Chris Andre. Our quietly efficient engineer is Matthew Olson. The KBU Evening News and Public Affairs Director is Jenka Soderberg. A podcast of local stories from this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. If you would like to call your elected representatives about any issue you've heard about on the news tonight, here are their phone numbers. The local number for Senator Ron Wyden is 503-326-7525. The number for Senator Jeff Merkley is 503-326-3386. And Portland Mayor Charlie Hales can be reached at 503-823-4120. You are listening to KBOO Portland, 90.7 FM, on K282BH Philomath, at 104.3 FM and K220HR in Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Brian Pritchett.
And I'm Aaron J. Bernard. Coming up tomorrow morning on KBOO, at 7, it's Democracy Now! With journalists Amy Goodman and Juan Gonzalez. At 8, Joanne Hardesty hosts Voices from the Edge, progressive talk radio from a grassroots perspective. At 9, Teresa Mitchell hosts Press Watch, news you're not supposed to know. At 9:30 on Press Watch, host Per Fuggering interviews insurance actuary and writer Gail Tverberg on the growing gap between the price that oil exporters require to keep drilling and the price that importers can afford to pay. At 10, hear Air Cascadia, headlines, interviews, and commentary with Chris Andre. At 10:15, hear Flashpoints, investigative news radio with host Dennis Bernstein. At 11, on Between the Covers, host Leanne Kranz welcomes Oregon author and creative writing teacher Stephen Allred to discuss his debut-linked short story collection, A Simplified Map of the Real World. And at 11:30, on Black Book Talk, a program focusing on works by African-American authors, hosts Patricia Welch, O.B. Hill, and Emma Jackson Ford present fall reading suggestions. Thanks, KBOO members, for your generous support. If you are not a current KBOO member, you can become one by going to kboo.fm and clicking on Donate Today. And stay tuned now for more national and international news from the worker-run collective at Free Speech Radio News.
This is Free Speech Radio News for Wednesday, September 4th, 2013. In Los Angeles, I'm Dorian Marina.
I'm Jess Burns with headlines for FSRN. Thousands of Romanians continue to protest a proposed Canadian-owned open-pit gold mine in the Roșia Montană region of the country. It would be the largest mine of its type in Europe. The government is expected to vote in the coming months on a new law that would speed up the approval process. Activists say the mine will negatively affect the environment and impact the cultural heritage of the area. FSRN's Donna Lepidot reports from the capital, Bucharest.
Since Sunday, between 1,000 and 2,000 protesters have been gathering each night in the capital for an unauthorized protest. Freedom, they say. We die, we fight, we save Roșia Montană. On Sunday and Monday nights, demonstrators blocked roads downtown. Police did not interfere with the non-violent actions. Last night, protesters established themselves in a public area in the city center, chanting slogans like "Abolish that law" and "Gold for them, cyanide for us." The Canadian company Gabriel Resources owns a controlling share in the Roxiamontana mine, which is reportedly worth about $15 billion. The company says its new state-of-the-art of mining facility will bring jobs and boost the economy, but acknowledges that many families will have to be relocated for the project to move forward. The law being considered by Parliament would transfer an additional 5% of the mine ownership from Gabriel Resources to the Romanian state. Lawmakers are expected to act on the legislation soon, but a tentative proposal for a nationwide referendum on the issue is also in the mix. Protest actions are expected to continue through the week, with a larger gathering scheduled for Sunday night. Dana Lepodat, FSRN, Bucharest.
In the UK, global environmental watchdog Greenpeace today set up a noisy fake fracking rig in front of the Lancashire Council office. The councillors are considering whether to allow energy company Quadrilla to continue drilling operations in the county. Today's action follows similar protests throughout Britain over the past month. FSRN's Francis Ngwa reports from Liverpool.
Workers in the Lancashire County Council in Preston today were confronted by 10 Greenpeace protesters who had constructed a mock drilling rig in front of their office. They erected an 8-foot fence around the display to prevent police from dismantling it. The activists have been loudly playing a soundtrack of drills, trucks and industrial plants in an attempt to demonstrate to lawmakers the noise that is generated when someone lives near a drilling operation. The Greenpeace activists are lobbying the councillors to deny an application from Quadrilla Resources to dig more wells as they try to extend their operations across the UK. The company's previous drilling efforts were halted after a string of minor earthquakes in the area. Quadrilla is the same company at the center of weeks-long protests in the southern English town of Balcombe. Its current drilling permit expires at the end of September. Quadrilla withdrew a request to extend its drilling operations, but on Tuesday, officials said they intend to apply to carry out further